Welcome to the Mind State Marketing Hour, the podcast for business owners like you who want to learn about behavioral science and how it can transform your marketing and drive more business. This unique concept comes from Will Leach, author of Marketing to Mind States, and co-host Steve Brown, the author of The Golden Toilet. Every week, they bring you the latest in behavioral science-based marketing to uncover practical, real-world methods to designing marketing that compels your customer to listen, care, and act. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to the Mind State Marketing Hour podcast. With that, let's get into this week's show.
Here we are, we're jamming. It's the Mind State time with Will Leach. It's been a while, Will. What's going on, man? We got a little beats going. We got summer vibe. You haven't shaved in a couple of days.
Yeah.
We got
I'm an island time. Yeah. I just got back from a great vacation with family and friends. We were out in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I missed you guys. I missed you guys over on the show, but it was time. It was time to break away and let you guys, see some of the older episodes. And I think we got some good feedback on that too, which is positive. So I'm excited about that. A lot of YouTube visits and a couple of subscriptions. So I appreciate that all. And yeah, I'm back. I'm back to bring on the show.
All right. So here's our intro. It's the Mind State Marketing Hour with our favorite scientist, Will Leach. He's a mad scientist. He's a scruffy scientist. And look who he brought, his his sidekick, Christian Aloma, PhD.
Right.
PhD. What? That's, I was trying to riff there, something house, whatever. We all know what PhD is. Welcome back, team.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be back. Happy to be back in the as the launch after the hiatus, I guess, after the break.
So that's right. So we're gonna keep things still chill today because I'm still on island time. I've got this.
Well, I'm Caribbean. I can do that easy.
I know you can. Well, hey, let me kick us off here a little bit. Let me introduce to everybody on the show, Christian Aloma. He is the founder of Threadline, a marketing research, design, and branding agency, and author of the best-selling book, Start With the Story, Brand Building in the Narrative Economy. So today we're going to talk about that journey. Hopefully you're cool with this, a journey of being an author, things that you learn. But then I want to dig into some of the topics on the book as well.
Yeah.
And just help some of my research people out there try to understand a little bit more about, you know, the narrative economy and narrative stories and how that's integrated into brand building, all that good stuff. So it's going to be a fun conversation. Glad to have you on the show, Christian.
Well, always happy to be here. Thanks for having me. So I appreciate it.
Narrative economy? What's that?
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, no, it's it really started this concept of the narrative economy when I was looking at how, in my academic work, consumers use brands in their lives, right? And one of the things that you very quickly come to realize is every time we engage with a brand, purchase a brand, wear a brand, you know, express and show someone that we are sort of supporting a brand in some way, shape, or form, we are telling a story about ourselves, right? We are trying to communicate to them that, you know, oh, I love this sort of local coffee shop because I support small businesses, and I like this organization because, you know, they are giving so much of their revenue to, you know, protect the planet or whatever it might be. And so what I started to come to realize is that, you know, people purchase products and services and engage with organizations not just because they provide some rational value or some rational benefit. They engage with those brands, especially, you know, the brands that they are sort of deeply engaging with or repeatedly sort of purchasing, because it helps them tell a story. And so, you know, if you're navigating that economy as an organization, managing brands and managing products and services, if you're a marketer trying to sort of figure out how to, you know, get the most return on that economy, you've got to recognize that you're basically selling and exchanging stories for that, right? And so that sort of is at the heart of the narrative economy, is that the economy doesn't just run on product attributes alone. It runs on the ability to sort of tell a story.
I love that.
Yeah. So how many stories are out there? You're just talking about, you know, the importance of stories in our lives. How many stories are there? I mean, there's lots of books that say there's genres of stories, but that's a really interesting question for me.
Yeah, no, it's a really great question. You know, it's, there are certainly most likely, you know, an infinite number of stories by far, but you will see some folks try to sort of identify a clear pattern of stories overall. And, you know, the one that a lot of folks reference is like Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Myth, right? And that is certainly one of the stories, but it's not the only one that exists. It is just one of the most universal stories. That's certainly as far as told from a cultural perspective, right? Of a reluctant hero who's called to action, who goes through a transformation, who, you know, rescues their community or serves their community and things like that. But when we look at consumers and consumer behavior, you'll have different stories from how does this help me tell a story about how confident I feel, right? How successful I am. Can this help me tell a story about my relationship with my wife, my relationship with my husband, things like that? And so you look at it and there are these sort of just infinite number of stories being told by consumers. What we sort of talk about and help clients understand is that in all of those is a bigger narrative, a more universal narrative, right? And that's the sort of distinction between we've created between story and narrative, which is story is the way these sort of things are expressed, but narrative is the big idea. And so the example I'll sometimes give is, you know, one of the big popular narratives is that love always wins, right? And you can tell a story about that narrative either with Shrek, the movie, right? The Notebook, or When Harry Met Sally, right? Like all of those are very different stories, right? Engage with different audiences, but are basically sort of communicating the same narrative at the end of the day. And so, you know, as an organization, as a brand, looking to figure out what are the narratives that we kind of connect to, what are the narratives that we sort of allow, that's part of understanding, you know, your customer stories and sort of the major ones. So if you're McDonald's, for example, right? You may be sort of contributing to a narrative of, am I a good parent? Am I a fun parent? Am I a busy parent, right? Am I a successful parent? Because I can hit the drive-thru at McDonald's, make all the kids in the back of the van happy, make sure that they're getting a meal today, and not necessarily, you know, get stressed or feel taxed by having to be in the kitchen for 2 hours to prep a meal for all these folks today. Maybe I'll do that tomorrow, but not today. So McDonald's can fit into that narrative in a really sort of meaningful and distinct way.
I've been thinking a lot about this. You know, we see ourselves, we wear brands, let's just say Carhartt or whatever that is.
Yeah.
And why would I wear Carhartt? Because I see it as a complimentary component of my identity, how I see myself. If I'm, you know, if I'm rugged and I'm working outside and I go to the restaurant later and I wear Carhartt, I'm communicating that I'm that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And so we see brands, whether they are a compliment to how we see ourselves in our story and in how we're going about life and where we're going, or we see brands that don't. And, you know, recently things have been in the news where a certain brand maybe changed the message and then really upset the you know, what was going on. And all of a sudden, someone that had seen themselves carrying that beverage.
Yeah.
Okay. All of a sudden it's like, oh, this is not congruent with my identity. And now they're looking for a replacement. And I think it's a great time for the other competing brands to go, now's the time to really hone where we fit in people's story, because there's market share that we can attract, that we can take advantage of this big, giant mistake that's been made.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because there's one, and I can't remember if I talk about it in the book, right, which is a lot of people had purchased Volkswagens years ago because they were committed to the, you know, sort of lower emissions, diesel fuel, all this sort of stuff. And so they were owning these cars, driving these cars, trying to express to the world, like, I am an environmentalist, right? Like, I care about the environment. I want to reduce emissions, all that kind of stuff. And then you had Dieselgate, is what it was called at the time, right? Where Volkswagen had inherently or essentially made up emissions numbers. And the numbers were actually far worse. And, you know, when you go back and you used to look at some of the customer feedback and some of the responses and you check it, like the way customers reacted to that experience, you will see like language of betrayal, right? Language of, you know, the very sort of identity challenges that you were just talking about of like, what does this say about me, right? Like, I now look like this idiot in the neighborhood who was promoting environmentalism, and my car is the one smogging up the neighborhood, right? Like, yeah. So totally agree. And that is sort of, I think, part of the challenge is that when that narrative breaks, you know, when someone is sort of engaged with your brand to help them tell a story about themselves and you fail in that, or mm-hmm. you intentionally or inadvertently betray that, right? They're kind of left in the lurch. They're left in the middle of a story that they can't now tell. And if they can't tell their story, they can't express their identity. And if they can't express their identity, that's hardcore emotional stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Christian, and let me take that a step further. So in my head, where I took that was brands can make mistakes. Maybe, you know, just like you were talking the beverage brand, right, Steve?
Yeah.
Or the Volkswagen. Let me take that specific example because I remember that story a little bit differently. They certainly messaged that they were environmentally sustainable, even though they weren't. But they took it much farther. The way I understood it is that they used programming to trick.
Oh yeah.
Emission systems. So not only did they say they're environmentally sustainable, but then you know they rigged numbers. They actually actively.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Fucked the system inside their cars for years, and that's a different level of betrayal.
Oh, for sure.
So one to me feels, and I don't know if this is true, one feels I screwed up my story, but as a, like, I can make a mistake, right? As a brand, right. But then there's some like, wow, you really blew me away. You're nothing like the story I had. Do you see that there is a difference? And then can you recover, you know, in the case of lying or saying the wrong thing one time versus in that case, I mean, that was a huge deal. They misrepresented what they did for years. And they actively cheated and they got sales. They did so much in the industry because of that. So is there a difference and can you recover?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I always like to think that you can almost always recover if you provide a meaningful sort of resolution or apology or what have you. Right. And a lot of it is also dependent on what you've done. Right. And, you know, so if it's more of a, you know, disconnect, right. Or just a honest mistake in regards to, you know, bad timing on a social post because the culture sort of had moved on and you didn't realize it. And, you know, it's faux pas type of thing, right? You can typically recover from those sorts of things if you are, you know, there's crisis sort of marketing, crisis management, things like that, that you can sort of handle and deal with that won't necessarily like break the relationship in that. Between the brand and the consumer. But there is a difference between those two that you're describing, right? And typically what we see is a couple of factors that will drive how hard it might be to recover from something like that. One is how closely tied to my identity is this relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you know... If let's say it's an area that's not all that connected to your identity, like the brand of toilet paper that you use, and you find out they lied about something, right? You know, you may not care all that much. It might be an easy one to just switch, or if it was something and it was like, hey, I don't know what's happening in the industry, but I don't have the energy or the resources to research if the other toilet paper companies are doing the same thing or not, right? Yeah. Not perhaps as critical, but if you're, again, sort of someone who is proclaiming themselves to be an environmentalist and, you know, you are buying these electric vehicles and it turns out inside the electric vehicles, they're clubbing seals, right? Like that's going to be harder for you to recover from, right? That's going to be harder for you to sort of detach and sort of repair. Now it's possible to repair. I think almost any relationship is to some degree possible to repair. It just may take a lot more work to do so. And you may not have it repaired as a brand before they find someone else to fill that gap.
That's the scary part.
I think it's kind of interesting. There are certain aspects of your narrative, your brand narrative that you can control.
Yeah.
But then there's an external factors that you cannot control that can impact your brand narrative negatively.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I describe it as, you know, in the book, one of the things I sort of attempt to do is to define what a brand actually is. And I think from my perspective, based on the way people engage with brands and buy brands and behave with brands, brands are relationships, right? And we have been able to label a thing a brand. And so that makes it very much this sort of object that we feel like we can study and observe and manage, right? You have brand managers. But if you were to replace the word brand with relationship, that's likely sort of a better depiction, right? Like you don't have brand managers, you've got relationship managers. And the thing about a relationship is that neither one of the parties in the relationship fully owns the relationship. It's that space between the two individuals where there's potential for noise and chaos and misinterpretation and all those things that can affect that brand, can affect that relationship, that again, as a brand manager, you may have no control over. Right? You can't, and you can only respond to and adapt to that relationship and figure out sort of how you fit into the relationship today, right? You know, one of my favorite examples is from the diaper industry, right? You see, one of the main things that diaper brands attempt to do is to sort of maintain relevance across the child's lifespan, right? If you're just talking about, like, you know, preventing smelly trash cans because the infant is just, you know, pooping all the time, you're going to miss the point when that child is moving around and running around and engaging with a parent there, or getting into, you know, the transitions and, you know, even potentially getting beyond that. Right. And so they have to figure out, as a brand manager, how do we relate to the parent across the sort of lifespan, not how do we relate to the job that we're doing for them in any given moment.
Great, great thing. But let's take a step back, because I'm interested in, you know, there's a lot of things you can be doing with your time. You got kids, you got a business, you speak. What was your inspiration for writing your book?
Yeah. You know, I think at the heart of it was a couple of things. You know, I realized, both being a marketer and being marketed to, right, how much influence marketers have in the world, right? I don't think people realize how much we shape as marketers culture and people and moments and things like that, right? Like, you can probably not move through the world right now without finding at least 5 brands around you in some way, shape, or form, right? Like, if whether you're in a doctor's office, you're in a library, doesn't matter. Wherever you are, you're likely surrounded by brands, and in some cases, surrounded by marketing messages. When I realized that, and in doing the sort of work, the academic work and the psychology sort of studies that I've done, and realized how much people's mental health, people's emotions, people's feelings can be influenced by the brands that they engage with, I stepped back and I was like, oh, wait a second. Like, we, you know, you look at the beauty industry, and if they're constantly telling women in the world that you're ugly unless you use this product, that's not great, right? Like, that's a scary thing. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do in sort of response to that is to sort of, one, really kind of call out and acknowledge, like, hey, we do have such an impact in the world. Like, we fit into people's lives in ways that are much deeper than we probably realize, that certainly don't necessarily track on a balance sheet or on a budget tracker by any means. And if we recognize that, I wanted to sort of empower people to see, here is a effective and responsible way to both acknowledge the kind of impact that you have and also then design for that impact, so that as marketers, we can both influence sort of people's choices, shape people's choices, but also kind of help them fulfill the story that they're trying to sort of live out, right? Like, if they're trying to feel like a great parent, if they're trying to feel sexy, if they're trying to feel smart, we can help them do that without necessarily making them feel dumb first, without making them feel ugly first, without making them feel like bad parents first. And so I wanted to sort of just provide a framework to do that and provide what I think is one of the most effective ways to tap into people's minds, which is storytelling and narrative. And if you do that, and you do that responsibly, and that's because I recognize, I mean, Will, you're in the space, right? All of the sort of social science work that we do, all of the behavioral economics work that we can do, they're tools that can be used for good or evil, right? Like, And I presented the tools knowing they could be used one way or the other, but I really wanted to sort of set up and sort of communicate to the world and get this message out to the world that these tools can and should be, and we have a responsibility as marketers to use them for good. And that good can help both them and our business.
I think it's there's a point in a professional journey, especially in our industries or the, you know, when we're working with these brands, that we need to take this, all the stuff that's going on in our head, and put it in a consumable way so that folks can understand our line in the sand, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
It's something in us that needs to convey, here's what I believe and why. And I think that the folks that read those books, they connect with us more and they appreciate, they align with us. And it's because instead of why should I do marketing to mind states, it's like, how do I do marketing to mind state better?
Yeah,
I love that. And I think I really started to hit me that the people that I really appreciate and get value from sat down and emptied their head out and got it organized and put it in a way that I could get what they're promoting fast. And
yeah.
It's like, I found it valuable. I brought them in as a aspect of my self-identity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like love
what you said, Steve, real quick, was that I think there's a maturity as an author, but also as a reader. So there's a book back here somewhere and it's called How to Get Anyone to Do Anything. And the guy looks like he's maybe 25 years old. And he comes at it from a very nefarious, like, how do you get a girl's number? And he uses a behavioral psychology trick, or how to get somebody to mow your lawn. It's not even tongue in cheek. He's being serious, but it's about using behavioral sciences to, in almost every one of the examples, these 24 laws or what are the 24 things of getting somebody to do something for you. And then what I think is as maturity comes, and Steve, I know you've gone through this maturity process, right? You've said it. Where all of a sudden you don't do things so much for yourself. You start thinking of the broader legacy you're going to leave behind, the broader, and then Christian, it's absolutely through your book. I mean, it's throughout your book, the importance of that. And having that maturity to not only just write in that style. That's why I don't think 25-year-olds should be writing books. I just don't think, not like what we're doing. They just shouldn't.
Yeah.
They're coming from a different perspective, a very different place. And it's, I don't know if especially sure it's their fault. But there's maturity in also reading that stuff too, right? As you're reading that stuff, yeah, as Christian, we've talked about this, I can scare people into buying my product. I absolutely can do that. No problem. There are some real ramifications for using fear in your marketing. And like you said, there's real ramifications by showing people their ugliest selves. And now how I can make you become less ugly. Like there's some real ramifications I don't think we've thought about as an industry. And when you scare somebody, the budget sheet can be impacted immediately. But what you're doing, what you're saying, when the whole industry for beauty care, I would argue since the late 60s maybe, has been very much focused on, you're not very pretty. Let me show you how to become pretty. And that's like 30, 40, 50 years of messaging, hitting an entire three generations of women and men now. Men in more particular, or sorry, impact men as well. A very gradual decline in self-confidence. And we got some long-term brand benefit and we feel really good about our brand, but at what cost?
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, what you described is I think spot on, because it's very much, you can use those techniques. The question is that the relationship you want with the consumer, right? Like if I somehow sort of browbeat someone into being my friend, right? Like that's not a great relationship, right? Like that isn't the kind of relationship where if I'm in need, they're going to come to my rescue, right? Like you hear those stories of, you know, back when the airlines were in sort of big trouble and Southwest's customers were mailing them checks because Southwest had built such a relationship with its customer base that the customers just weren't buying flights. They just didn't want to see the company go under, right? Like that's loyalty. That's sort of, I think, something that's really powerful. And to your point, Will, you know, we're seeing a shift in some of that, right? We're seeing, this is part maybe why I love 25-year-olds because, you know, they are expressing values and shopping on values and forcing brands to really sort of declare their values, where you see like Aerie, which is a brand from American Eagle Outfitters, and they produce intimates and lingerie and underwear and bras and things like that. They're one of the first brands in the midst of, you know, the Victoria's Secret era, where every model was just the kind of unrealistic definition of beauty. Aerie said, we're going to stop retouching our models. We're not going to sort of create this sort of perception. And there's a big question, right, about like, are you sure, like, is that what people want to see? You know, sex sells, right? That's what people say, all that kind of stuff. But what they really committed to was, listen, we're not the ones who define sex, and wearing our clothes isn't necessarily always about sex, right? It's not about being the sexiest. It's about feeling good with yourself, about feeling good about who you are and feeling good in your body. And there are actually studies coming out now, academic studies, that demonstrate that the women that have engaged with the Aerie brand, their self-confidence measures are actually going up, because they're seeing models who are imperfect, who look like them, who are shaped like them. And they're saying, well, if they're, you know, confident enough to be in this image, to you know, portray themselves, to display themselves in this kind of an ad, I should probably feel better. You know, I could feel pretty good about myself doing the same if I wanted to, right? And so we're seeing that just almost direct impact of using an approach where you're saying, I want to create better stories, and seeing how the customers react to that. And you're likely going to build those customers for life as a result.
Yeah, so many things. The, you know, when I published my book, I was excited about this thing I poured my heart and soul into, you know, and you're putting yourself out there. You're asking folks, please read this and critique it.
Critique it, yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
And then I found the thing that was the most I was shocked, or I didn't think about it. It was like how some people felt offended that I wanted them to sit down and read a book, my book. It's like, I don't read, Steve. I don't like to read. And it's like, I just didn't expect that offensive.
Yeah.
You want me to read a book? What, do you hate me?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you said something earlier, Steve, about, you know, you pour your sort of head out and codify these ideas and craft these ideas. And I just, my first reaction was like, I wish it were felt as easy as that was, right? Like, to just pour my head out and have a book. But, you know, as you all know, right, it's a labor, labor of love, a labor of pain, I guess. It's there's so many things. And so then when you produce the book, yeah, that's a piece of your identity out in the world floating around. And so I get it, you know, and like, you know, I'm trying not to, but like checking out every review that gets posted on Amazon. Yeah. And I'm like, I can't take this personally. Like, I know I'm not on the scale of, you know, like Harry Styles and the things people might say about him, but like, you know, those, you know, two reviews that I get, I'm like, oh my goodness, they thought that's what they took away. Oh gosh. Yeah.
Oh man. I got killed on December 25th, Christmas Day. I'm going to guess like 2019, you guys could go see it. It's my worst review, because Amazon always hits the worst reviews. And when he does, it's so hard. This person, I don't know if it's a guy, comes out and says, this book is a story of Will Leach's and his personal stories. And he's so egotistical. He just wants to talk about his personal stories. Now, I remember making the with the editor, right? Telling him, I'm not going to go do case studies, because everyone has these case studies. I want to talk about my personal life. And so I remember us making this big decision as, you know, a unit, like, I'm writing it. I didn't want to write from other people's cases. I want to do my personal experiences. And just seeing that current, it was so horrible to see somebody do that. And you have this initial reaction, right? See, like, you want to just get on there and say, hold on. Like, you want to reply, but like, this does nothing. It's no good to do that, to try to reply. So I even talk about, all right, I'll send you a book for free. There's all these things that are in your head. The criticism is so hard, because you're right, it is your self-identity. Like, because these stories are my personal stories. I lived. I had the emotions of being fired. Oh, yeah. I had those things. And have somebody basically say it's all drivel, because it's all about him. He's so focused on his self-esteem. It was painful, man. It was a painful and surprising thing to go through.
Me his name, Will. I'm gonna find him.
I know. Let's go. So, Christian, thinking of surprising things, like, what was the most surprising thing about writing the book that you uncovered, whether about yourself or maybe about the process? Like, what was surprising?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I think what was probably most surprising was you hit it on the nail earlier, right? This sort of maturation process. And I felt like in the year or so it took me to write this book, I am not the same person I was when I started the book to when I finished the book. And not just because like I produced a book, but you know, going through that process, which I think I understand, Will, why you're sort of even so sensitive to that review of like, there is so much work that you have to put in to not just getting ideas out of your head, but actually re-articulating ideas so that they fit into other people's heads. And the vulnerability that comes with that of saying, okay, no, that's how I understand it, but does that even make sense, right? And trying to unpack that and then repack that. And I, God, there's just, you know, I saved the things that were cut as a document, right? And like, it's probably bigger than the book itself, right? Like the number of times I rewrote something and then scrapped it and then tried it again. So that like process, which has made me a better communicator, a better presenter, a better writer, to like say, listen, like, you know, just because I think this idea is great doesn't necessarily mean it's clear or it's relevant or it's effective, or like just because I love that story doesn't necessarily mean that's a story that I need to tell or it should belongs in the book or makes the point I think it makes, right? And so there's that like just really kind of critical process. And I don't mean critical either, but as important or necessarily as like negative, but just critical as like, you have to constantly assess if this is the thing that needs to be written. And if this is the point that you're trying to make, and if this is the, like, you're constantly analyzing that content. And that, I think, you know, after a year of doing that, it feels more comfortable to do it now, but it still kind of sucks, right? Yeah. Like it's still every blog post that I try to write, I'm like, okay, I've written 1,000 words. This needs to be 400. And what do I do to make this point as clear as possible to the person reading it? And so, you know, Steve, you said it too, right? It's like, what are you doing to me, Steve? You're making me read a book. Like, I think good authors spend so much time thinking about the reader that, you know, to hear someone be like, what did you really expect me to, like, you want me to read this? Like, yes, I want you. I literally wrote this for you, right? Like, yeah, I had you in my head when I wrote this, right? Like, and so, yeah, I kind of do. And ouch, right? Like, you know, sorry, you don't have the time to read it. And I get it, you know, and that, again, that's what you're writing for. Like, you're trying to write for kind of those. Certainly you want someone who wants to read your book to read your book, for sure. But everyone that wants to read your book doesn't necessarily have the same capacity or the energy or the background to understand the book in the first pass the way you wrote it. And so I was constantly revising and constantly sort of trying to make it like, do I need to make this point again, or is this enough? Right. And things like that. So that was probably the biggest.
Honestly, for those out there, like if you're thinking about writing a book, the best thing you can do is get a great editor. So I had a story about being in the Army. I wanted to talk about boot camp, just explain a concept in my book, because I felt that was relatable, because I spent some of the most emotional things in my life happened in 8 weeks in South Carolina. And I remember the editor was like, Will, I know you think it's good. I know you do, but it's just not good. It's not relatable, and it doesn't say what you want it to say. Yeah. But you get so much in your own head, because this is my life. This is something that's so clear to me. So if you're out there looking at writing a book, I think, maybe you guys think differently, an editor is a great investment because they cut so much out.
Yeah.
That stuff that didn't really matter anyways. When I look back, I didn't even need to have that whole concept. But in my mind, when I was writing, I spent a good 2 weeks on the whole story about boot camp and the things I learned about psychology and using drill sergeants as my example psychologist, and realized that it was just convoluted, embarrassing, boring, didn't match anything I really wanted to do. Editing is good.
I agree. Go ahead, Steve.
This is going to bring us back around to brand. This discussion we've been having has been how we took time to define our brand. our book represents our thoughts and what we stand for in a way, right? And then so people that read it are going to develop a relationship with us from reading that book. But I think in the brand, when you're a brand, you're going through a similar process. You need an editor.
Oh, yeah.
You need to not spend time in boot camp on your products. You need to make sure that you're resonating and thinking about who? Your customer, not your story. I think this is so cool.
Hardest thing in branding to do.
It is the hardest thing to define your brand really clearly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I think that's a really awesome point, because I think I was having a conversation with a client yesterday about this. I would say, and this is a plug for all my insights professionals out there, the insights department is the brand editor, right? They are the ones who are constantly thinking, are you sure your audience wants to hear that? That that's important to your audience? That that story will resonate? Like, a good insights department is checking the brand authors that are in the marketing department, right? And really making sure this is what you're trying to say, and that you understand this is who your audience is, or this is who the audience will be if you start talking like this. You know, it's insights roles are just so critical, I think, to successful brands, because they are, you know, they're the one that gets the consumer the best. They're one that gets the audience the best.
Wow. You think of things that are trending in the news. You want a news jack. You know, how can our brand jump on this and make some traction on this trend that's happening?
Yeah.
But if that brand editor doesn't have the courage to go, guys, I know everyone's doing it right now, but this is antithetical to our core audience. Do you really think this is smart that we do that and risk? There's a point in time that you as a consumer will switch from a long loyalty of a brand to something, maybe a change of life, a change of status. Maybe a woman becomes pregnant and she the smells of her favorite brand are offensive to her. She doesn't realize it, and that's why she's attracted to this new brand. And these folks that are in charge of these brands are introducing a moment of permanent, or at least generational, I was thinking about Volkswagen while you guys were talking. There's a whole new generation that's oblivious to that story that are just buying Volkswagens now. Sure. But they had to wait for a certain audience to age out before they could resume sale increases.
Yeah. That's true. Well, and that's in my perspective, right? Why narrative is so important. And obviously I'm biased, being a guy that studied narrative for his entire PhD and career. But, you know, when we focus just on emotions can be very tied to a single context, right? It's, I want to feel confident. I want to feel like a good mom. I want to feel like a smart professional, whatever it may be. But consumers are not trapped in a moment in time. Consumers are living a life that goes through those stages and those moments and those different contexts. And if you are looking to build a relationship with them, right, and you are a brand that's willing to sort of adapt with that relationship, you can follow those moments, right? You can adapt with that individual, right? You might recognize, you know, the product we sold you 10 years ago is not the product you need today. And that's why we have this other line of products and services. And that's maybe what you need instead.
Hey, Christian, let me push back on that, or maybe it's more of a question I had. But in chapter 2, you talk a lot about, you know, how to build relationships. And I think you probably take it into a deep, I would have rewritten that, how to build deep relationships, right? Because you actually go through a pretty structured analysis of relationships, and you come up with, there's these seven depths, right? Familiar stranger, the acquaintance, a colleague, close connection, friend, inner circle, and platonic soulmate. And so you go through a lot of depth and really help brands uncover the importance of relationships, how to get to these different levels. But here's what's going on in my head. And it speaks to what we just talked about, is I thought, how do you build relationships in a world that's hyper competitive? You just said, I have 5 to 10 brands around me at all times, and more companies are being introduced every day because it's so easy to make a company. So how do I build these relationships when there's many more attractive girls out there, attractive boys, but also we have 8-second attention spans.
Yeah.
Like, how do I build a relationship when I'm always looking to the next brand? I'm always looking to the next thing to entertain me. How does a brand think about that? Because that'd be really scary. You just talked about life stage issues, but now I can make the case it could be in one day. Your customer could be moving on to something different in just a day, as it used to be maybe 3 or 4 years.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, it's a really great question. And one of the things I'll say is, you know, not every brand needs to get to that depth, right? You know, that scale that I have there, and I had a conversation with a number of organizations. I was teaching at a course in at Kellogg, and they were questioning the same thing. Like, if I'm in the middle of that, how do I get to platonic soulmate, right? And the thing is it's a bell curve, right? Not every brand becomes a platonic soulmate to a customer, certainly. So one of the questions is, what kind of relationship do I want to have? Do I need to be that deep relationship? Am I comfortable with a relatively sort of basic, you know, kind of acquaintance kind of relationship? Because they use my product pretty regularly. We can turn over. We can manage it. We do it well. But to your point, you know, how do you break through all of that? You know, I think it's the metaphor I always sort of use is basically the same metaphor it comes to when you build deep relationships with people in your lives, right? Like, it is not going to happen in that day, right? It's going to be in a potential sort of experience of building a level of trust in this relationship that they can rely on you and they can respond to you. And building trust can take time. And you can accelerate some of the elements of that. And what I mean by that, so one of the perspectives of trust is that it requires capability. So you can do the thing that you're promising to do, right? Like, if you're a soap brand and you don't actually clean their hands, right? Like, that's, you don't have the capability to build trust. That's the easiest one for most brands to accomplish, capability, right? You typically have developed a product or service that can accomplish the goals of the promise. So there's capability. And then there is what's known as consistency. So not only can you do that, but every time they come to you, you do that for them, right? At least almost every time. And then the third element that we talk about is reliability. And reliability is basically a reflection of those two first elements over time, right? So you're doing it, you can do it every time, but you've done it every time for a long period of time. And what that starts to sort of build is, I know that even if things go wrong, right? Like we talked about earlier at the beginning of our conversation, they will repair it. They will make it up. They will fix it in some way, shape, or form, right? And that's why one of the sets of questions in that survey in the book is, do your customers believe you have their best interest in mind? Yeah. And, you know, when I may purchase something that is in a moment, right? If I get something from someone that's like, you know, in awful packaging, the packaging is torn, it almost looks like it's been used already, right? I immediately build and develop a set of perceptions about this brand that's not very reliable. I probably can't trust them to like fix anything that might go wrong. Now, if I switch over and I get something from someone that is tightly sealed, right? I mean, and small elements, right? Like the packaging is actually packaged, right? Like it's not just like shaken around in the box. It's they care about it. Maybe they included like a little card that, you know, suggested or thanked me for the purchase and suggested the best way to sort of start using it, things like that. I immediately get a sense that they care about more than just my sale. They care about me. And that might be a moment, and it may not accompany any major marketing campaign, any major sort of marketing push or messaging, things like that. But there will be a little part of me in the back of my mind that the next time I want something like this or something that is related to that company, I'm going to think favorably of them first. And that's essentially sort of, I think, where brands in a competitive landscape win is, how fast do the neurons in their mind connect to your brand? And if you are constantly sort of building that sense of trust, trust is a shortcut, right? That's why we build trust. So we don't have to reevaluate every relationship that we have over and over and over again, is that once they see you, all of those different questions are immediately answered and they can go forward. And if your answers are better than the one next to them, no matter how fancy that, like that marketing campaign was, they will sort of move towards you. And again, it's a competitive space. So it's always a challenge. There is no perfect answer, but in everything you do, you should be thinking about how does this build and establish the relationship that we have with this individual? How do we build that trust with this individual?
Yeah. Okay. Makes a ton of sense.
Excellent. Now, can you make them feel understood and safe with your brand? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Christian, I'm going to turn on music now.
All right. Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys. Oh, we lost your sound, Steve. Or did I lose? I lost sound.
Am I back? Yeah.
You're back.
He's there back. You
So what's this book look like? Do you have a...
I do. Here, let me...
Show it.
Okay, you got it. So you can pick this one up. This one is actually Will's book. I have.
You can't buy Will's book out there.
Is this a signed copy? But this is the book. Super proud of it. Super happy with it. It's available on Amazon in a bunch of different formats. My recording session is scheduled to get the audiobook done.
You're going
to
do the audiobook.
Doing the audiobook. So if you've enjoyed my voice on this episode, know that you're going to get a couple of hours of me doing that with this book. Kindle, hard copy, paperback, whatever you need, it's available and it's up there on Amazon and things like that.
Awesome. So, Will, another great conversation, man.
This was a really good one. I learned a lot more. I thought I kind of understood kind of the narrative economy there, Steve, but I didn't. I'm glad this is really useful. I answered a couple of questions I've had. And if you hate the sound of my voice, everybody know that my Audible book is not me. We actually had a talent come in who sounds a lot like me, but with less nasally.
Because of that egotistical feedback on the Amazon?
Couldn't stand it, man. You're right.
If I tell the story, they're just going to double down. Guy. Yeah.
It was a comedian from Kansas City. I'm like, all right, I'll take him. He was great. Perfect. I love the guy. Good.
I read mine. I thought, I wrote mine. I should read mine. You know what I learned is I should have recorded after I finished my manuscript. I should have recorded it first because there were things in there I would have manipulated a little bit.
Just
because hearing myself read it out loud. It was hard. It was hard to read it.
I was going to say, Christian, it's hard. I was going to say, you have to know where to pause. It's harder to do this voice. Good luck.
And I'm going to be tempted to riff on things. And I'm like, nope, that's not the book.
But you should.
Word for word.
Yeah. Word for word. So we'll see.
All right. So rolling out here. So if folks want to reach out, maybe you've connected with Will's brand on this conversation. Will, what's the best way to connect with you and work with you?
You can visit mindstategroup.com. And, what we do is we help brands understand the language, the words to use, the visuals to use based upon these psychological mind states, these moments when people are making decisions. We study those moments and help brands build messaging to attract more clients. So go to mindstategroup.com to learn more. Lots of good papers out there. Lots of videos you can learn more about as well.
And check out Will's book. It inspired me to write mine.
There you go.
There it is.
I think I have the original version with it.
That's going to be a collector's edition.
That's right.
Get some money on eBay with that one.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we'll roll out here. Good job, guys. Appreciate you.
Yeah, great, great. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, always a fun conversation with you guys.
Awesome. All right. Did you know we're a podcast? You can go listen to this podcast out there on all the cool places to listen to your podcast, or you can watch the show on YouTube, the Mind State channel. All the 100, I don't know how many conversations we've had, Will.
Over 100 now.
Over 100. All right, ending the broadcast.
Thanks again for listening to the Mind State Marketing Hour podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you stay up to date with each episode. And please share this podcast with others who could benefit from hearing Will's insights on all things marketing. Each episode has supporting information in the book, Marketing to Mind States. And for more information, visit us at mindstategroup.com.